This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to bioart and the future of 3D printed human organs. This week, Microsoft shows its cards for the next generation of consoles as it shows off the Xbox One, which will go head-to-head against the PlayStation 4 later this year.
Plus, a skyscraper covered in thousands of tiny bristles is the novel proposal by a Swedish architecture firm for turning a building into a wind power generator.
And Google's Eric Schmidt has said, we have to fight for privacy or we're going to lose it. But what does that really mean?
All that and more will be discussed as we dive into the best of this week's Wired News.
Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast a free audiobook of your choice from a catalogue of over 80,000 titles. To claim yours now, go to audible.co.uk/wired and sign up for your free trial and your free book.
I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm Ian Steadman.
And this week we have, first, a new intro, as you've just noticed, but also no Liv, because she's working on a feature about bioelectronics and electroceuticals, apparently. So she's understandably a bit busy.
Yeah, I watched her mind be blown every time she had a conversation with a new professor.
Mm. Well, I think that feature's going to be out next week.
I believe so, yes.
Wednesday,
early
possibly. Yes. So later on, yes, we're going to talk about the Xbox One. I went over to the launch. So we've got a lot to talk about that. It's kind of a new console launch is always interesting because they tend to last now for about a decade. And so we're really kind of seeing what Microsoft and Sony think the next 10 years of home entertainment is going to look like. So quite a lot to discuss there. But first, we want to talk about something called the straw scraper, Ian. It's a hairy coated building that generates wind power.
It is indeed.
This blows my mind.
This is a proposal, an experimental radical idea from a Swedish architecture firm.
Of course.
Yeah, there's this building in Stockholm called the Södertorn Tower. It is apparently the joint tallest residential building in Stockholm. It's 80 metres high, 24 stories. When it was built in 1997, it was actually meant to be 40 stories tall originally, but it was designed by a famous architect called Henning Larsen, but kind of fights over the construction and stuff meant that it ended up shorter, and it was a compromised vision. He got very angry and stormed off.
Artists.
The building's there today, and it's a kind of boring building, but Belichu Labs, which is a Stockholm architecture firm, they want to add the lost 16 stories back to the building. And the way they're going to do that is the first four floors at the bottom are going to be a new restaurant and viewing platform, which isn't too exciting, but the rest of it is it's going to be a generator, a wind power generator.
No,
and they're covering the building.
It's going to be hairy.
Yeah, but they're covering the building in hair.
That's the genius. It's not turbines and it's not blades or anything like that. They're going to stick large sort of plastic covered hairs to the building. And the way this works is quite clever. There's piezoelectricity, which is a kind of electrical current that's generated when certain materials are subjected to sort of being bent or squeezed or stressed, which most commonly happens with quartz, which is how you generate ultrasound waves. You send an electric current to vibrate a piece of quartz and it fires out some ultrasound waves. Human bone apparently does this as well, as does sugar particles. Lots of weird stuff does this. The idea that Belichu Labs have had is to build giant hairs that they haven't said exactly how long, but I'm presuming, you know, kind of a meter at least, which are, have a core of a material that's piezoelectric in properties with a plastic polymer coating. You attach thousands of these to the outside of the building, and as they move and sway and rustle in the wind, the movement generates a current in each hair, which is then goes into the new turbine thingy they've built in the core of the building, and that generates power.
Whoa. This is pretty incredible, but I have to say, when I saw the pictures of this hairy, hairy building, I did think, how nice is this for the people inside? Because there's a lot of hair. It doesn't look like there's any daylight.
Well, there are so many windows, but yeah, I think it's going to go over
It like covers the whole building.
At the same time, though, isn't it kind of worth it to be able to say you live in the hairy building?
I don't know. I like light.
So
I like daylight.
I'm curious, how much power is this thing going to generate?
I'm not sure, because this is not something that's actually going to be built. This is a thing that architecture firms often do, which is the idea. They propose things which are theoretically possible, but are just really cool.
And then people like us go, oh my God, there's this amazing firm.
I did ask them kind of how much power do you think this could generate, and they gave me some links to some research papers which did prove that this is a viable technology. It could work.
Mm.
I looked through the papers, and the closest example of this kind of technology being used was a 30mm straw in a lab, which with 16km/h wind, which is kind of like a standard slight breeze that you might get any normal day, that's 1 milliwatt of power, which means you need 1 million of those straws or hairs to power just a microwave or something like that.
Seriously hairy building.
Yeah. I mean, if you sort of think about extending a 30mm hair to 1 meter or 2 meters long, and then you work on improving the efficiency of converting the movement into power, you can think about it might be able to do something like power the lights in the building or the lifts or something like that.
But this is all this
power
is all
the lights to replace the daylight that you can't have anymore. There's gonna be really strong lights.
But I feel now this is kind of overshadowed by the fact that it's basically just a proposal, and this genius idea for a hairy building that sort of, you know, has a toupee that generates electricity now seems more like art than science.
Well, can you imagine if it only powers the light bulbs that you only have to use because you've decided to black out the building?
Once again, though, you'll be able to say my light bulb is powered by hair movement, which I don't, which is pretty weird and cool.
Okay, well, let's keep our eye on this. I think it's an interesting proposal, one of many, and we will return to it at such point this building gets given its hair. I want to talk about hardcore sex.
You
Liat.
Always want to talk about that, Nate.
But I want to talk about it on the podcast today.
Okay, it's finally appropriate.
It is. There is an angle here. Danish movie director Lars von Trier has an upcoming film called Nymphomaniac. This much we knew. It features scenes of real, unsimulated sex. This much we knew. However, it turns out that the pornographic body doubles will perform the sex and then have their lower bodies digitally merged with the upper bodies of the all-star cast, which includes Charlotte Gainsbourg and Uma Thurman, by the way, who will be simulating the sex scenes. So it will look like these actors are having hardcore super sex, but actually they're just pretending, and the porn doubles have been have had their dangly bits spliced underneath them. Speaking to the Hollywood Reporter in Cannes, the film's producer said, quote, "We shot the actors pretending to have sex, and then we had the body doubles, who really did have sex, and in post, we will digitally impose the two. So above the waist, it will be the star, and below the waist, it will be the doubles."
So we're getting 100% authentic naked Uma above the waist.
Yes, you're getting 100%. Well, if she particularly is in one of these scenes.
Oh, right. Okay.
But I mean, the film is about I think, a woman recounting her sort of sexual life from teenage to adult, and
Lars's,
you know,
dream.
Yes, I mean, he's a big fan of Charlotte. Something of a muse. Anyway, but it was worth noting, the same report actually highlighted that the massive amount of time that it takes for them to do this digital genital transfer is actually caused delays that prevented the film premiering at the Cannes Film Festival.
Are you serious?
Yeah, which is a shame, because I was actually at the Cannes Film Festival this year, and I would have very much liked to see how this came out. They're doing two versions of this film, actually. They're doing like a hardcore version that has sort of real sexy scenes included, and then a softcore version
for the kids.
Yeah, I think that will be maybe obscured. I don't know exactly, but
it'll just be shots of a butt going up and down,
oh,
but nothing actually.
Yeah,
yeah.
But he's done this before. He had real sex in Antichrist.
He didn't.
Yes, he did. Yeah,
really?
At the very beginning.
I thought this was the. It was like a big debate over.
No, it was
left
real.
It as a question mark.
No, it was no. I've seen the film. It's very real. Oh. Yeah, it's and there are lots of other films. Like Caligula actually had a lot of real sex. And
wait, so not Charlotte Gainsbourg's already had real sex in one of his films?
No, there was she was with William Dafoe in a shower, and then they sort of there was like a cutaway to the lower bits, and they were body doubles.
Don't
anyway,
you feel like Lars should just give porn stars a fighting chance to prove their acting skills?
Well, the thing is, this is actually one of the arguments that's been had online since we published the story this week. Yeah, is it say, well, this is all, you know, it's a great story in terms of sort of how filmmakers are digitally manipulating porn bodies onto actors' bodies, but it raises the question, why not just have actors either who are prepared to do the sex or just not include it at all? It's an interesting one.
I'm sure they'll find some people. There are lots of porn actors who are trying to get legitimate film careers, like James Dean and Sacha Grey and stuff. So
I'd like to see how they do the credits at the end. Bottom half of Uma.
Now that
in
is
scene
a brilliant
52.
Yeah, that is interesting. If you get, you know, testicles one.
Defoe's testes.
Okay, we could go down this at great length.
You're listening to the wired.co.uk podcast. Got a comment? Drop us a line or several lines on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Eric Schmidt, Liat.
He's such a lovely man.
It's not every podcast. I bet this is the first podcast ever that has gone from hardcore sex to Eric Schmidt.
In the space of challenge.
1 minute.
That actually surprises me.
Yeah,
that actually surprises me.
If you find another one, let us know. Leah, what's going on here? You went to Big Tent this week and he's been saying some funky Schmidt.
Yeah, I quite like him. I realised coming away from it, though, that I just kind of bought into stuff he was saying because he's kind of quite charming. And then a few hours later, I'm like, do I agree with this Schmidt? I'm not so sure. So basically, Google in the past has obviously come under criticism for all kinds of privacy concerns over the years, and recently with kind of sharing your data across all of its different services. Now, at Big Tent, Schmidt was warning against giving up your data too easily. His argument has always basically been, don't put it out there if you don't want it found. It's too hard to completely delete things on the internet these days. It's virtually impossible. So therefore, we should instead be educating our future generations to be cautious what they post online. He was kind of basically saying that kids these days, their digital identity, you know, which is kind of perceived and modified by others online, strangers, could stand to outstrip their real identity, which is kind of the same thing you saw with that girl who worked with the police and crime commissioner's office, who kind of tweeted some really offensive comments. And then, you know, that's going to follow her for life. But basically, they're saying, you know, kids are sharing their thoughts younger and faster than they're actually maturing. I agree with the sentiment, but then you kind of think, it's a little bit of a cop out just saying parents control your kids. Like,
no, I mean, I think that social media etiquette and internet, etiquette, I guess, should be part of a school curriculum.
Yeah,
this to me has far more significance in schools than, you know, here's how you use Microsoft Word, because kids,
because we're not idiots, you can figure that out. Yeah,
yeah, and far more useful would be to educate them on, you know, things like what are the implications of things like search engines caching your data, of things like the Internet Archive, that archive every page on the internet. What does posting something online today mean for you tomorrow? Because it's
also
a lot of
just be nice people and don't post really obnoxious stuff.
But the thing is, I doubt any of the three of us have, at any point in the past, posted something on the internet that at the later date you think, I should have done that. Mm. I've done it. I've done it several times, probably just today,
yeah,
to be perfectly honest.
I find this quite strange for something that Schmidt says, because it's a bit like a cigarette company voluntarily putting warning signs on the packets.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, they're saying you don't do this, but you know their entire business model is predicated on you still doing it.
Yeah.
But is that the case, though? Because firstly, Google, being a company at the size it has a corporate responsibility to be educating people into not screwing themselves in the future.
It depends on what kind of privacy you're talking about, though. I mean, you'd never hear Mark Zuckerberg say, don't share stuff with your friends, because Facebook's entire business model is based on that.
No, but it's more like, but with Google, take a step back and think about what you're sharing.
Well, yeah,
it's not share stuff.
I would, for instance, consider my privacy to include my browsing history. But that browsing history, being Google needs to be able to track me throughout the web to be able to offer me advertising relevant to what I've been looking at. But I took actions to prevent them tracking me, then that kind of undermines the business model.
It does in a way, but it's a case of opt-in versus opt-out. And that's a much bigger debate as to whether everything should be opt-in, as in we're going to roll out this new feature, you have to choose whether to use it, versus we've rolled out this feature, if you don't want it, then disable it. And Google, on its web tracking, is opt-out. Like,
you have to look for it.
Yeah, it's a setting, I think, when you sign up, but by default it's checked, and you can disable it and delete it at a later date. And for a lot of people, I mean, for us, if you look at any of our search histories, they'll probably look like the ramblings of a madman.
Oh my god! I like deleting mine routinely.
But we're not just Googling. I mean, honestly, some of the things I searched for when I was researching Lars von Trier's, the history of unsimulated sex in movies. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you sort of think, well, you don't want that to be public, because if taken out of context, i.e. from a journalist or from, you know, whatever, then it's always going to look a bit bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess he's talking specifically about stuff you're sharing on social media sites and comments.
Making unprofessional comments.
Yeah.
I want to talk briefly, actually, about tax.
Yeah.
But I don't want to bore anyone with talking about tax.
Oh,
but it's a massive topic this week. Apple's Tim Cook's been up in front of the Senate committee defending its practices. Google's Eric Schmidt's been on stage. Ed Miliband, I think, was at big tent as well.
Yeah, it was hilarious. He was like the keynote speaker, and it was evident everyone knew he was going to come up and kind of give them a hard time for it.
Who was? Ed Miliband.
Yeah. And he absolutely relished the fact that David Cameron had earlier in the week, like Downing Street had said, we're not going to talk to Eric Schmidt about this week. Yep. He just reveled in the fact that he was there challenging Schmidt, who wasn't in the room and was, I think, probably on his private jet on the way there. But he was basically saying Google and companies like it are failing to engage in what he calls responsible capitalism. So i.e. not just simply doing things for the most profit, but doing something that's good for the country and the whole ecosystem and kind of like fair play. I mean, which obviously is not really the way capitalism
Yeah, but a lot of the argument has been the fact that there are, it's estimated that trillions of dollars and pounds are being kept in overseas firms and prevents that money from coming back into the country in which that company is doing business. But there's another angle to this, actually. I mean, Google and Apple come under fire for things in, say, Ireland, where, you know, you pay a tiny amount of tax for having a company based in Ireland, and it's actually, you know, doing other countries out of significant amounts of tax. But for Ireland, like, they're incentivizing companies to do business in there. I mean, Apple, I think, employs about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people in Ireland. So it's in Ireland's interest to attract people to working and developing in its country by having tax
I did read that Apple negotiated with the Irish government an extremely competitive tax code for just that. It's like 6% tax or something, just for that exact reason.
Yeah, I mean, we have the same thing in East London. There's big movement to attract people to work in the East London with better tax breaks and incentives, so that we're basically not losing our talent to overseas.
Well, Schmidt made a big point of saying it doesn't really matter what you guys do with tax. If you want to charge us more, we'll pay more, but we're going to keep investing in the UK because we love it. It was kind of banging on about that. But I mean, he's absolutely, they've done everything by the book. They've done legally, they haven't done anything wrong.
People like Eric Schmidt have a legal responsibility. Their shareholders could remove them from their positions if they don't take measure to
that's in the best
increase profits.
At the same time, you know, when a government is going on and on at you, you're gonna have to like concede at some point to have some kind of conversation.
Otherwise,
you have to appease
sort of,
but it's like the US.
That's the problem, isn't it? I mean, if the UK and the US both crack down on it and they both start enforcing very strict regimes, which mean that there aren't these loopholes, I mean, they're just going to move elsewhere to a different loophole.
Well, they're talking about going at the G8. They're going to have a big debate on international tax. Well, they might have a debate about international tax laws, because the whole point, it doesn't work unless you all agree to the same thing. This was another reason Ed Miliband was just hilarious. He was just like, even if, you know, the international community does not agree to do this, we, if we're in power, are willing to go out on our own, because sometimes you just have to do the right thing. Well, and everyone was like, aren't you just going to lose us loads of business if you're the only ones doing this?
I think your passion for the subject is reflected in the 2 or 3 brilliant articles that you wrote for Wired.co.uk this week. If you search for Big Tent on Wired.co.uk, you will find Liat's reports from the conference. Lots more information in there. Coming up, we've got a bunch of brilliant segments, and we're going to discuss the future of video games. Liat, want to tell people about Audible? We started this thing last week, didn't we?
Yeah, we did indeed.
We have teamed up with Audible to give every listener, that's you, of the Wired.co.uk podcast, a free audiobook download when they sign up for a one-month free trial of audible.co.uk. In fact, we've been talking about Google chairman Eric Schmidt, and his book, The New Digital Age, has been added to the catalogue. There are over 80,000 other titles available, including the latest science and technology books, and fortunately, they work just like a podcast. So whatever you're listening to this on, you can probably listen to an audiobook on. Try it out. You get a free book for doing so. Just sign up for a one-month free trial at audible.co.uk/wired. Download the book of your choice and enjoy it on me, Liat, and Ian. There's no commitments. If you cancel after your free trial ends, that book is still yours to keep. So give it a go. It's audible.co.uk/wired. Second half of the show, which is where we introduce a range of discussion topics categorized by intriguing tongue-in-cheek segment titles. And we've got a new one to start this week. It's called Gaming the System. Gaming the System is our segment where we're going to be discussing video games and consoles. It will be a hot topic this year because the PS4 was launched, or was announced earlier this year, and earlier this week, Microsoft showed off the Xbox One. I went to the launch. It's a very nice, big, black, shiny box that looks like a Betamax recorder. And
The 80s is very in right now. So.
Yeah, it's 80s revival, never went away.
Yeah.
So we wanted to talk about not just the Xbox One, but also a little bit about what these next generation of consoles are going to do for our living room, because very much it came across from Microsoft, and to a large extent as well, Sony, that these aren't just for gaming. These are going to be positioned as the center of all of your home entertainment. But first, let's just talk briefly about the Xbox, the new Xbox. It's going to be called the Xbox One. It's coming out later this year. It's got a redesigned Kinect sensor that works much better as well, by the way, in smaller rooms. It's got a much wider angle lens, also records video in 1080p for video calls and things. Both a new controller and the Kinect will come with every single Xbox, and it will always be listening to its surroundings. So you can literally turn the Xbox on by just saying, Xbox on. You
I
don't have to press any button
all the time. Like, it's going to be confusing.
There's as we're going to come to shortly, the console's got a massive focus on home entertainment, but the specs for the gaming side of things are pretty amazing and on par with the PlayStation 4. It's got an 8-core CPU and 8 gigs of RAM, and apparently the graphics performance of the Xbox One is 8 times the Xbox 360. So look
eight
at
times
your
what part of the graphics of it?
Well, in terms of, you know, polygon counts that can be rendered, shaders, shadows, lighting, things like that. In terms of the raw processing power that is available to a developer to exploit, the capacity is 8 times what is available on the Xbox One. So if you have a look at sort of the latest Call of Duty or something that pushes the boundaries of what the current model can do, just imagine that with 8 times the potential in terms of graphics. It's pretty good. When I was at the demo, they showed off a few examples of what this next-gen stuff looks like, including Call of Duty Ghosts, a new Forza game. And, it does look amazing. They went down to the detail, and there was a few laughs, actually, in the audience. In the Call of Duty demo, they sort of showed a model of one of the soldiers, and they were sort of showing the detail that can be rendered in real time. They said, you know, we're now able to go into so much detail that we can literally render the dirt under a character's fingernails.
Wow.
Like, that's the level of texture we're going to. You know, they're talking about sort of self-reflecting skin textures and stuff, so it's not necessarily just about how light hits the skin, but also how that light bounces around the skin on the surface of a character, which is one of the things that makes a big difference when you look at a CGI face versus just a live human face. We're talking incredible detail here, and a lot of it was quite funny because you just, like, we're sitting there thinking, really, dirt under the fingernails? Like, that's literally what you're putting as a top selling point. But it's more about, I think, highlighting the potential of what can be rendered here.
Yeah,
and
Richard.
But the home entertainment stuff's pretty interesting as well. Microsoft's really presented this as we've said, kind of the center of a living room. So it's a massive focus on TV and streaming media. It's at least in the US to begin with. You're actually going to plug your sort of cable box, you know, so like the Virgin Media Skybox. You don't plug that into your TV. You plug that into the Xbox, and you interact with your TV, your program guides, all this sort of stuff through the Xbox itself, which means that it's adding on screen any social element that you want to your TV show. So it could be that, you know, it shows to your friends which program you're watching, or you can watch together. You know, all this sort of stuff. If you're watching movies, you could have like a Skype chat, because they brought Skype to the Xbox as well. You could have sort of picture-in-picture Skype chat as you're watching a TV program with a friend. So they're really trying to ramp this up as, like, it's not just gaming. This is about how are you going to experience everything that's on a TV screen.
Massively ambitious.
I think it's really exciting.
Yeah.
As someone who loves gaming but doesn't do it that often, I consume pretty much all kinds of media at all. Perfect.
It's the perfect.
You know.
Well, there are some other angles that I thought were worth pointing out. So the Kinect got quite a lot of airtime at the demo, but there were a couple of things that really stood out about this Kinect. The first is the amount of voice control that's going on with it, which is kind of interesting, but didn't really jump out. The other thing that I found was just incredible is the fact that the Kinect is so sensitive in its imaging. It can detect your heartbeat by looking at your skin.
This freak, yeah. Whoa. And what does it do with that? Because I read this.
So this is
incredible.
It's going to be used for these sort of fitness games. Like the sensitivity is now such that it can monitor more joints on the human body. So if you hold your hand out and sort of twist your wrist 90 degrees, it'll be able to detect that.
Okay.
It's not just about whether your arm is moving up and down. So it's much, much more capable of reproducing on screen or detecting, if you like, what's going on. And more joint monitoring means more people can be in the picture. But yeah, it can monitor sort of changes in skin. I don't say tone, but skin, flushes or palpitations, things like that. So it can it can detect your heartbeat from that.
Can they call the doctors if your heart stops?
I was about to ask that. Yeah.
Really? Yeah. It seems the obvious next step. If you're...
It is super exciting, but it also is a bit 1984-y, some people were saying. I mean, it's the whole kind of like, you know, your TV's monitoring you, it's listening for you all the time.
I want to be able to know it's off. I don't want to accidentally.
Yeah, it can't be off.
Just
turn You'll it. Have to unplug it.
Well, no, all you got to do is just turn it away or put a little blue tack on it.
Well, you can't
because
it's listening as well.
It's going to hear you, whatever you're doing.
You can put muffs on it.
It will recognize your image and sign you in based on the fact that it can see you.
And how do we not know that it's just got other keywords that it just like
has? How do we not know it's sentient?
Yeah, that they haven't told us about.
Now, this is the future, isn't it? Now, could you imagine watching a TV show and in the living room, you're talking about, oh, should we get some food? Should we get some food? Ad break comes on. Oh. Suddenly, local food ad.
No, really annoy me.
Want to throw that out there. Okay, let's move into our next segment. This is Meanwhile in Japan. So meanwhile, in Japan this week, Ian, you have reported that Osaka has beaten London to the, quote, turning a canal into a swimming pool idea.
It has indeed.
Go on.
Will do by 2015. You guys will probably remember this. This was a few months ago, the Lido Line. There was an architectural competition in London to find something to compete with New York's High Line, which is the old raised train track they turned into a public park, which is really cool. And Boris Johnson was like, we want one of those as well. The winner of that competition was to turn the Royal Mail Railway, which runs under central London. It's quite a small railway that's kind of been disused, to turn that into a public park / mushroom farm. But the runner-up was the Lido Line, which was to turn the Regent's Canal from Little Venice and Paddington to the Limehouse Basin in the Docklands into a kind of commuter swimway, which was kind of for leisure or commute or business.
Yeah,
I don't think they think people would swim the entire way, but you know, because it's like 13 kilometers or something.
We live in a really cold country.
And a really cold country. It caught a lot of people's imaginations. Osaka actually is going to do it. Not quite as ambitious. It's only going to be an 800 meter stretch of a 12 meter wide canal in the Dotonbori section of the city.
Okay.
That's probably why they're actually doing it. It's more feasible.
they're going to plug the either end of it with concrete, and they're going to fill it with clean water and have pumps and stuff. It's going to be a public swimming pool, which is going to be quite nice. Dotonbori is a area of the city that's apparently a bit, well, used to be a bit run down, was known as the theatre district. But recently, local city businesses and stuff have been putting a lot of money into there. They've built a boardwalk that's got a lot of food stalls. It's all a bit, you know, kind of nice and regenerated and family friendly. But at the moment, the canal, which is still there, is a bit dirty. It's known for being polluted. Apparently, fans of the Hanshin Tigers, which is the local baseball team, if they win a game, they like to jump into it as a part of a celebration. But if they do that from 2015, they'll have to pay 1,000 yen for the first hour, which is about £6.41.
Mm-hmm.
And an extra 500 yen, £3.20 for
that's totes worth
half
it.
Hour. Yeah.
The
total cost of converting the pool will be about £19 million, 3 billion yen. But the Japan Times, which is where I saw this...
Wait, no, 19 million.
That's what I said.
Yeah,
sorry, I thought you said 19 billion.
You're calling in on errors.
19 million, 3 billion yen. But local residents, quoted by the Japan Times, which is where I saw this, were sceptical, as apparently the canal is very popular with drunk people leaving bars and theatres in the area at closing time as a open-air toilet, and they don't think they're going to be able to stop people pissing in it.
Wow.
We'll see how they manage that.
Now, as a fan of all things wet and Japan, I kind of feel like I should go over there and review this pool.
You should.
The launch, yes.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised on this week's podcast, why not tell us about them? The team is waiting for your comment at facebook.com/wiredUK.
It's time for our final segment, What's Up With Space? This week, What's Up With Space is that there's a mass gerbil and mice death thing going on.
Been carnage in space this
week. I misread the title as I was reading it. That's why it came out like a garbled mess. Liat, step in, fix my words.
Right, so what's Russia has just killed a lot of gerbils and rodents. And It was just absolute carnage. They basically wanted to find out how they would fare if we head to Mars. It's a really, really long journey. And so far, animals going to space have had relatively short journeys. Like, we've got fish in the aquarium and the ISS. We've had monkeys go up. But this was a 30-day trip at 575 kilometers above the surface of the planet. But unfortunately, most of the cargo returned deceased. They took off in April, carrying mice, gerbils, newts, snails, crayfish, and plants.
Any cats?
No cats.
That's okay, then.
I know. Breathe easy. But so the plan was to see how they'd fare in flight, especially with the weightlessness. And they were placed in special cages that would open during the flight but close for landing. You don't want all those corpses floating around and banging against the walls. And their every move was recorded on camera. So they had 45 mice, 15 newts, 8 gerbils, an assortment of snails, plants and crayfish. And sadly, less than half the mice survived. All the gerbils died because of an equipment failure, which I think is just murder.
I heard the newts survived.
The newts, they're hardy. I mean, I think I'd expect that. They're, you know, thick-skinned.
There's newts they can't do.
So apparently this is the longest animals have ever spent in space. And it was done by the same team who did the experiment when they had astronauts in 500 days in isolation.
Oh, yeah,
I remember amazing that. Group called the Institute of Medical and Biological Problems.
Thing is, though, Russia's planning on building a base on the moon, aren't they? It's kind of like a stop-off point for going to Mars.
Yeah.
It's like sort of signs on the UK spaceport, like, next stop, Mars, via the moon.
Yeah. So they want to do that by 2030. They got to start sending some cats into space soon.
There was an amazing quote from the guy from the Institute who said, We lost half the mice, but that was to be expected.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, none of the gerbils survived.
Then why'd you take the mice if it was to be expected? Come on, guys. Couldn't you have just taken a couple and proven your point?
Well, if they're listening, they can get in touch with us, podcast@wired.co.uk, because we're going to wrap up the show. Don't forget, we've got Bjork coming to our big annual conference in, when is it? October, Wired 2013. If you go to wiredevent.co.uk, find out who's going to be at our conference. We've announced some new names. Liat, on a scale of 1 to OMG, how excited are you?
OMG.
Yeah, absolute.
I emphasize the M because I don't know why.
Yep, very good. And Liv will be back next week. We'll see you then.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.